This is HPR episode 1959 entitled, Fosdem 2016. It is hosted by Ken Fallon and is about 104 minutes long. The summary is, Mozilla Apache Jenkins X.doku Tiki and MediaWiki LFS Perl August Cola Google SOC Ultimaker.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
I'm back at the Mozilla booth, and I'm talking to...
My name is Francisco Pigolini from Mozilla. I'm a community events coordinator.
And for anybody who doesn't know, what is Mozilla and what sort of projects do you have?
Well, Mozilla, it's a software company. We are the makers of Firefox browser, which is being used by more than 20% of the market share right now. We were the first browser that faced Microsoft Internet Explorer monopoly in the early 2000s. So I think that most of the people know what is Mozilla, or at least knows Firefox as a browser.
How did you get involved with the Mozilla organization in the first place?
Well, Mozilla is based on the community. So basically the main access entry point, it's communities. You start volunteering. There's a lot of options for volunteer. You don't need to learn how to code or develop to involve in the community. I started helping on marketing and other stuff. So everyone can help. We have localizers. We have several stuff, people that helps on events. For example, in the Spanish community, we have people that are professional translators that are translating Firefox and the other products. Yep. So it's a couple of, not only one way to enter the community.
I think if you go to the Mozilla website, one of the only projects that you see that really comes to the fore is the Firefox browser. How are you with some of the, can you mention some of the other projects that you have?
Yes, we have Firefox OS, we have Thunderbird, we have privacy, we have a couple of other projects that it's not only the browser, it's basically let people enjoy their experience online and have the control of their online experiences.
I know during the year, a lot of people were a bit distressed with the introduction of the Pockets integration from a proprietary point of view. Was that a democratic decision? How did that happen?
Well, the thing is that we try to think on the final users, and most of the time we try to facilitate the life for the online for the final user. And basically, there's a lot of power users that we say that it's part of our community that in some cases they don't agree with some of the decisions that we made. But the thing is that based on studies and user usage, because we have a lot of studies on analysis of how the users interact with the browser, we find out the Pocket was a good feature to include at the browser. So we include it. We know that it's a third-party company, but there's an option to remove Pocket or not use it at all. If you're not registering, if you're not logging in the Pocket feature, that Pocket doesn't have an idea how you use that or that you use in Firefox. If you log in, there's an information on the private and the third party company, but we have a strict policy with the privacy. Yep. So it's not like we are giving away the data for our users. Okay. We are separate things, and the usage is completely anonymous.
Okay. One other question, and then we'll drop the controversial stuff.
Yeah.
The DRM, the facility to add DRM to the Firefox browser was also a contentious issue. Probably depends on which side of the free software debate you fall. So how did that go down in the community?
Well, the thing is that we are aware that the DRM, it's pretty controversial. Yep. But also, it's the same thing happened with Flash plugins and the codecs related to Flash. You have to choose whether you want to have people using your browser or whether you want people that abandon your browser and lose users because you cannot give them the full experience online. So it's a controversial. We want to have another option. We fought for, we fight all the time for having open source alternatives, but the reality makes us do complicated decisions. So it's not easy sometimes to make those decisions. We work with Adobe to have a DRM plugin more open than the others. But in the end, it's like Flash. If the other companies are making lobby to use proprietary software, and that's the only way to showcase media content, we have to try to deal or find a solution or a midterm solution for those kind of things. In the end, Flash is going to be dropped. So we hope that at some point, the DRM and all that stuff, like you cannot see Netflix, for example, if you don't have a DRM, will be dropped for an open alternative. But we are the only one that are fighting for that.
That's for sure. So what have you got here in the booth, and how do you go about organizing a booth like this?
Well, we have a couple of things. We have a VR kit where you can see virtual reality on the browser. We have Swag. We have Firefox OS devices. Well, not yet, because, but we had yesterday, and we will have later. And basically, it's all community lead.
But I thought Firefox OS was going to be dropped. Sorry.
No, it's not going to be dropped. It's going to be refocus on connected devices and the Internet of Things.
Yeah.
The new project is called Connected Devices. We will still using... No, no, we will still using Firefox OS as a platform for smartphones.
Yeah.
The only difference is that instead of selling it through companies like Telefonica, Deutsche Telekom, and all those people, Orange, we will be having kind of a everyone can install Firefox OS on their devices. Actually, we are developing that from several years from now. And the idea is that we are not selling devices anymore, but you can install Firefox OS in your Android device if you want.
Okay, so basically the carriers have monopolies and you can't break in there.
Exactly. That's the thing is that we ended the partnership with the carriers, so that's it. That's the only difference.
Okay, very cool. Is there anything else coming up this year that you'd like us to know about? I mean, obviously, we'll put contact information for how you can get involved in the projects in the show notes, but anything coming up?
We are in Europe. We are fighting a lot for the privacy. There's we had a talk yesterday about how the privacy affects the users online. We have a feature in Firefox, which is Do Not Track, and we have the private browsing that is completely improved in the latest version of Firefox. So the privacy thing is very important for us in Europe, worldwide, but in Europe it's more because there are a couple of laws ongoing that they want to restrict their privacy of the users. So that's one of the projects that we have this year. We will also promote Internet of Things, IoT. So that's another of the project that we will have ongoing in 2016. And we will have a lot of things ongoing, actually. It's not only one project that we have.
And what's the best way for somebody to keep up to date on what's going on?
Well, we have the blog, the Mozilla blog, in our webpage. We have you can check or contact your local communities. For sure, there's a community in your country. If you're in Europe, there's a community in each city or in each country, in France, Belgium, Italy, Slovenia, Croatia. So it's you can find anyone, and you can find a lot of options to help. So...
Okay, thank you very much for the interview, and thanks for taking the time. Hope you have a good show. I'm here at the Apache booth, and I'm talking to...
Hello, hi, my name is Lars Eilebrecht.
and you're with the Apache Software Foundation.
Yes, that's right, ASF. I'm one of the co-founders, so I've been doing Apache web server stuff basically since 96, and the foundation was created in 99.
So Apache, you worked on the Apache server, the original. How did you... Tell me your story. How did you wake up one morning and decide you want to write a server?
I think it would take too long to tell you my story, but...
We have all night.
Okay. I was one of the first German members of the Apache group, so that basically predates the foundation. At that time, it was just a random number of people, like a dozen people, developing the Apache web server. There was no foundation, no legal entity, nothing behind that.
Where did the server come from? Did you start it from scratch, or was it donated from somebody?
No, the Apache server was based on the NCSA HTTPD. At that time, it was developed by the by American University. They stopped the development, but it was open source. So some people who were using this already for commercial purposes, they're like, okay, I have all these problems, I have bug fixes, I have things, and one or two people decided, let's just get together, have a mailing list, and talk about how we can build something new based on the open source code that was provided by the NCSA guys, and they decided to call it Apache.
Because there was a lot of patches in it.
Well, there's a... which is a bit of an urban legend that the term Apache comes from the fact that it is a Apache server after putting all these patches together. But actually, the actual source of the name is actually, to some extent, a tribute to the American Native Indians, the Apache Indians. The simple explanation is probably that someone just liked the name and liked the whole idea, and someone came up with the feather at the logo and said, how about using this if we have this name? And within a few days, basically, people decided, okay, that's good. That sounds good. And that's how the name came to exist, basically. And we kept the name when we created the foundation in 99 and called it the Apache Software Foundation, ASF. And now we have all these... More than 200 top level projects. We have dozens and dozens of projects in the so-called incubator, projects which want to join Apache and will become an Apache project at some point, but are still going through the so-called incubation process at the ASF.
And what does a software project? How does the software project benefit from joining the foundation?
One benefit, well, there are various benefits. One is they join an Apache community. There's already some level of community there. There's people who organize meetups, Apache conferences, etc. From a purely legal point of view, one benefit is that with the Apache license, that covers a few things, and also for some smaller projects, if they join for the first time, there is a legal entity behind the project. So it protects the developers against patent-related issues, stuff that people have to worry about today. It's no longer like in the early 90s where you could just develop some random stuff, throw it on a web server somewhere and don't worry what happens to it. If you do that nowadays, depending what you do, people will sue you because of patent infringement or copyright violations, all this. And with Apache, you have that level of protection as a developer. And it's a great community, and it's a great foundation, and it's a fairly permissive license. So for many projects, it's very useful to be part of Apache because it gives you a better or a bigger, visibility.
And do you do coding now, or you're just mostly managing the foundation?
Well, I'm not so much involved with actual development anymore. I'm still on the mailing list. I like to think that I'm still a contributor, but to be honest, I haven't committed many things in the last few years, to be honest. So, but there's a lot of things people can contribute to. You don't necessarily have to be a source, like a software developer, to contribute. You contribute in many ways, which is just like writing bug reports is the first step, helping with documentation, helping to actually represent a foundation like Apache at FOSDEM and explain things to people. And and we even have people with like a legal background who've joined the foundation and help out the foundation with things.
What's the most common question people ask of you guys?
I think
it's not like, okay, I got this bug in Apache, please fix it, is it? Or?
Every now and then you get the people who ask like, oh yeah, I had that problem the other day, can you help me with that? And then it's usually a project you don't really know anything about because there's just too many. The majority of people, I'm still surprised that many people still very much associate the name Apache with the web server and don't really realize that all the other tools and things they use are actually Apache projects as well. People sometimes don't realize that how many Apache products they actually use, whether in the actual development or as a tool. Or we have even OpenOffice, which is a purely end-user focused, like an end-user application. Whereas most of the other stuff at Apache is more like for developers. So we have different audiences for people who use our software.
Okay, now that you brought it up, because I wasn't going to, but fine. There was a lot of debate in the community about how beneficial it was to the community in general that the OpenOffice project exists and that it found a home under the Apache umbrella, and that effort wasn't better spent in just migrating to LibreOffice.
Damn it, I shouldn't have mentioned OpenOffice, should I? But then right next where I'm standing, we have actually some guys from the OpenOffice project. They definitely know more about how this all came to be. To be honest, I wasn't really much involved in how this happened. I think it's, to some extent, I mean, that's the nature of open source. If there's two groups or two people who want different things from the same code base, then fork it and do your own thing. That's perfectly valid, and it's one thing you can do with a permissive license as the Apache license. So if someone thinks today, I want to do something, call it whatever office, then take either the LibreOffice or the OpenOffice code base and develop based on that. That's perfectly fine. Competition is good to some extent. It's, on the other hand, a bit sad to see that you have these two groups basically developing the same things to some extent and to some extent competing against each other. But then I'm not really involved in these two projects, so I'm the wrong person to ask about what's exactly going on.
So what's your goal here from FOSDEM this year?
Unfortunately, the ASF has, I think, never really officially been at FOSDEM as a foundation, which is quite amazing given how big the ASF is. So it's good to see Apache this year at FOSDEM. Hopefully next year we maybe can do something bigger with the dev room or something. One reason why we're here is actually just 3 days ago we launched a new look for the ASF, which is a new feather logo. So it looks a bit different. I was still around, well, when the old logo was basically created, which was more than 20 years ago. That's how old I am now. But I guess, I mean, it's on one hand very sad to see the old feather logo, which has become very iconic. It's basically represented in not all, but many of the individual projects as well. They use the feather logo somehow in their design. Not all of them, but some. So with the new logo, it's just change. And I guess change is good.
Well, it's not a million miles from it because I didn't even notice the difference, to be honest.
It's actually very true. Some people don't notice, but it has a bit of a more modern look, I would say. And
it's been Ubuntuized, I think. So is there anything else you want our community to know? Or?
Well, check out apache.org. Look at all the various projects that are there. Maybe you even notice one or two that that you've actually already been using and didn't realize it's actually part of Apache. So check out apache.org and start contributing.
Okay, thank you very much for your time and enjoy the show. Hi, this is Ken. We're at the Jenkins booth and I'm talking to...
I'm Kosuke Kawaguchi.
We spoke to you 2 years ago about the Jenkins project. Can you give everybody a quick reminder about what it is and what it does?
Right. So the Jenkins is an automation platform where people, the software developer in particular, use it for automating build, test, deployment, releases, basically everything around the writing source code.
So what sort of language is it written in, and how do I deploy a server? What do I need to deploy a server with this?
Right, so the Jenkins is written in Java, but it's also packaged as a Docker container, Debian package, RPM, and so on. So it's really easy to get started.
Okay, and are you tied down to any particular? So is it tied down to software in particular, a particular software language, or is it more flexible than that?
So one of the great things about the Jenkins community or its ecosystem is that we have this incredible plugin community that produced about thousands of plugins, literally more than 1,000 of plugins, integrating it to just about any language you could imagine. So whether you're doing PHP or Java or C Sharp or .mini or Ruby, we have a set of plugins that really gets you off, up to running quickly.
Okay, so I'm a new developer. I've got some code and I want to write in, I don't know, looking around Perl. What do I need to do in order to... I've written my program. What do I need to do in order to... It's a hello world. That's about as far as I can get. What do I need to do to test that in Jenkins?
Right. So the most typical thing you do on Jenkins is, you know, you have Jenkins monitor the source code, and every time a new change lands in the source repository, rather, and you can set up Jenkins to, well, basically fork off a process. It's probably easier build and test. And then after that, you tell Jenkins where you're like a test report or where you want the email to be sent. So all that can be configured from GUI very easily.
And this will be monitoring something like SVN or Git or something like that?
Yeah, and then we support just about any version control system we imagine, thanks to the plugins. So I think the very common ones nowadays would be probably Git and Subversion, you know, maybe Parforce. You can do those through the plugin that we have.
Okay, so my Hello World program, what sort of test case would I write for that?
Yeah, so perhaps the simplest form of quote-unquote test might be just compilation, right? If you commit some change that doesn't even compile, that's kind of a test. So perhaps you can just have a make as a step, and then if that fails, then you know that you committed something horribly wrong.
And that is, it returns error 0 or 1, anything other than 0.
Yeah, so as long as the tool returns non-zero exit code, Jenkins should notice, oh, something went wrong, and then it cut out the build, and then you can tell Jenkins to send out the email or maybe like a pop you on the Slack or whatever.
So if it returns 0, then I can look for the string hello world, all uppercase.
Yeah.
If it's lowercase, then that fails.
So yes, if you're writing a test, you'd be probably doing it by test tool that's specific to a language. But yeah, you can do assumptions like that.
Okay. And how can I configure, you know, some things I'm not that worried about if they fail, some things that if they fail more than that, my manager needs to be aware of it?
So if you're using the test framework that produces a test reports in a format that the Jenkins could understand, there are often ways to say those test failures are not critical. And then so that's how you can differentiate, like, you know, the problematic one, the non-problematic one.
Okay. So what have you been doing since we spoke last? Yeah. What improvements? Right.
So thanks for asking, because right now what we are showing in this demo, the booth here at Postdem, is the work we are doing for the 2.0, the next major release of Jenkins. Yeah, exactly. Which is a kind of big deal for us, because we've been on version 1.something for the past 10 years. Yeah. So there are a number of things we are trying to fix, but one of the major push is this introduction of the new subsystem called pipeline as code. So, you know, I talked earlier that, well, you can, if you're starting fresh, you can do that by GUI, by configuring what we described from the GUI. But as your scale of the software development goes up, it's often actually, a substantial section of users we prefer to do it as code. You know, kind of like how the ops people now manage their infrastructures with code. So we define this textual format in which you can describe the build and test and the email and all that thing. And then all you have to do is to commit that as a Jenkins file in your source repository. And then Jenkins would automatically notice that, oh, you want this branch of this repository built. And then it starts automatically building every time the new change comes in. If the pull request is filed, that also gets tested, that sort of thing. So Jenkins suddenly becomes a lot more transparent.
It's very, very meta, the whole... You commit the test thing and that fires off the test.
Yeah. So it becomes, in a way, when if you think about what the great butler is, it's probably somebody you don't need to ask every single detail. That is, you kind of expect him to take a cue from what you're doing and provide the services for you. So that's what we are trying to turn Jenkins into.
So Jenkins, a bit like Jeeves a muster, and Jenkins is the butler. So.
Yeah.
Has everything ready before you even know you wanted it?
Right, right. That's the kind of thing we're trying to do. Yeah.
Excellent. So you're going to be doing that all year, and that's...
We are hoping to release it soon.
Yeah.
We are still working hard. There's a lot of rough edges to polish, but it's coming close.
Is there a release build that we can check out and submit bug reports?
Yeah, so we should be. We really wanted to have that actually going before coming to this conference, but as with all this stuff, I couldn't make it. But that should start really, really soon.
Yeah.
Yeah, we want to provide this, you know, beta drops and so on to get the idea across to the hands of people.
And I presume you automatically test Jenkins using Jenkins.
Yes, yes, naturally we do that. Yeah.
Checking in, test, check in files to run, test, check. That's going to play with your mind out for a while. So, is there anything else that I missed that you want to keep us up to date?
No. Since this is a great podcast, maybe people can see, but we also brought like a new version of stickers.
Yeah.
So, clearly, people hearing this are going to miss them. So, next year, I'm looking forward to seeing you in the booth at Fosden so that we can hand you stickers.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You are?
I'm Anka Luka, and I'm from the xwiki.org project.
What is xwiki?
So first, the booth, which is actually wikis and CMS. So it's a common booth to multiple wiki projects.
That's why I couldn't find any logos on this.
No, there's... Yeah, exactly. So it's a couple of wiki projects that came together to this booth. So we proposed it together, and we're sharing it. So xwiki is a wiki which, on top of the standard wiki features, which allows you to just write text, documentation, your thoughts, whatever you want in the wiki, you also have a way to create and to use structured data, meaning that you can add metadata to your unstructured data, which would allow you to find it easier, to organize it better, and to also guide your content producers into producing a certain type of data. For example, imagine if you want to, so in any team, basically, there's a need at some point to take some notes of the meetings that are happening in the team.
Yeah.
So traditionally in a wiki software, if you would like to document that in a wiki, you just type the text and put it on a page in the wiki. But there's some important metadata about that meeting that would better be in all these pages. For example, the date of the meeting is important. Who participated to the meeting? When did it take place? Where did it take place? And all that stuff.
Yeah.
So in xwiki, instead of just telling everybody put that in the text, in xwiki, you would actually create a structure with the metadata, location, time, participants, and so on.
Yeah.
And when people would edit the page to create the meeting notes, they would get directly a form where they would fill in data in a form.
Yeah.
They would still have their big text area where they put whatever text they want, because that's a principle to let people the freedom of organizing the information the way they want. Mm-hmm. But you would also have this structured part of your page where you can actually... create structured information. This might allow you, for example, to find all the meetings that happened during the last week,
or related to a particular
topic, or related to a particular topic, and so on.
So does this come out in the browser as like a schematic, extra namespaces within the?
It comes out in the browser as a structured page. So it's as a page with fields and then with the text of the meeting.
How flexible are those fields? Can you define them yourself?
You only define them yourselves. There's
okay.
Nothing that so you
is this
only
done
define
by
them
an administrator
yourself.
Or is it done by you?
By anybody who
as
has the rights. Yes.
Who has the rights?
Yes, because who has the rights meaning that there's users in the wiki, which
yeah.
is what the wiki platform provides.
Yeah.
So there's users, there's groups, and there's rights. So you
okay.
can tell like if you basically everything is stored in a wiki page, including the structure.
Okay.
So
yeah.
you just need to give rights on the page that contains the structure. And that's how people get rights to edit the structure. That's it.
Okay.
It's not magic behind it.
And xwiki is not DocuWiki, and it's not... It's a different project.
Yes, xwiki
okay, so
is
I'm
not DocuWiki, and it's not Tiki. You have to talk to everybody on the booth.
Okay, excellent. No problem.
Okay.
And it runs on what? What do I need to...
Oh, it's a Java. So it's written in Java, the
yeah.
backend. So it runs on the Java application server. So
yeah.
you need a Tomcat, JT, whatever application server you want, to just deploy it and it runs. And the front end part is written in based on Bootstrap, so it's very mobile friendly. Yeah. So it just adapts to screens. And with the JavaScript part in jQuery and some scripting part, for which you can basically kind of choose the language. It's the what we write it in Velocity templating language because it has a big advantage of being easily sandboxable. But you can write in other languages if you want, like Groovy or Jython or stuff like that.
Okay, cool. Is there anything that you're planning on implementing this year or?
So right now we're working on the, because in any software that is about adding content, the editors are quite important. So like the what you use, and our rich text editor today is a homemade rich text editor, and we would be working on integrating CK editor in it, which is a bit more powerful today than what it was a while ago. And we just implemented a new way to structure the data in the wiki based on nested documents and nested spaces, which the result of that is that your whole wiki is a tree of pages, an infinite tree with infinite levels of pages, and it's easier to understand how it's organized.
One of the criticisms of wikis in general is the chaos.
Yeah, it's a chaos. Now, this structuring, so besides the fact that we every wiki, I guess, it's working on the organization of the pages, XWiki, in addition, by this structure that they add to pages, makes it a bit easier to kind of figure out where you are or what you're doing. For example, when you land on a page that has a certain structure attached to it, it would be easy to understand that it's a page, for example, dedicated to a meeting and not just any page. But besides the text that is in it, it also has a marker in it, like on it, to say this is a meeting page.
So then, as somebody with administrator rights would identify, for a meeting page, I need these particular fields.
Yes.
And you, as a regular old Joe user,
yes,
you are forced to fill in all that stuff, whether you like it or not.
I'm not sure you're forced. I mean, you're not forced because by default, there's no validation in that. If you want validation, you have to code it. So you can just leave the fields empty and go straight to the part where you type text and keep your old habits. Yeah. So the fields are more like a guidance, if you want, because when a content producer would see a structured form, they would understand, oh, here I need to put the date of the meeting. So it also helps to guide people into creating a certain type of information, which is easier to understand and use.
I get it. I am on board with this. Nobody else is, though, but I am definitely on board with this.
Okay.
So where could our listeners get hold of it and contribute to the project?
So in order to get in touch with the project, whether it is for download or for contribution, you just need to go on xwiki.org, xwiki.org.
I'll tell you what, let's put that in the show notes and we'll have it for later.
Okay, great. So you go there and there's a download part and there's also a community part where you can see how you can contribute. The sources are on GitHub, so you can also search XWiki on GitHub and just dive directly in.
What's the license?
It's a LGPL license.
Okay, cool. And I'm talking to...
I'm Michael.
Michael, you're from the DocuWiki.
Yes, I'm from DocuWiki.
And tell us what DocuWiki is, aside from it being a wiki.
It's a relatively simple wiki. Yeah. One feature many users love is that it doesn't require a database. So it's relatively easy to maintain. And we had also many users coming here today who told us they have a wiki and it's just running and it's working fine.
Yes, and you can check stuff into Git and you've got your version control done.
Actually, we are not using Git.
Yes, but I save my documents in Git and then I have version control.
Yes, LocuWiki has its own version control, which is really simple. We just save compressed versions of the old content.
Yeah. So how did you get involved in the project and why did you choose not to use a database or Java engine? What do I need to actually run it on a web server?
You need PHP because DocuWiki is written in PHP. You also asked why I got involved in the project. I personally joined the project, I think, around 2008. I was looking for a wiki, which also is able to run a blog. And DokuWiki actually has plugins to support blogging. That's how I got involved into DokuWiki. And then I, I got more or less in a developer meeting at FrostCon in Germany. That was in 2008. And since then, I've become, more or less a core developer of DokuWiki.
Okay, very good. Whose idea was it originally to use text files?
It was Andreas Gore, our main developer. And he did that while he was working as admin for a company. And he was looking for a wiki to document a server setup. And he wanted to have something that also works when the server is down. So, for example, if you have a database-backed wiki, if your MySQL server or whatever you're using is down, you can no longer access the content. And you can't access a database with a text editor. That doesn't work. DokuWiki has simple text files. You will find a page literally in a text file. You can even edit that text file. That still works.
One thing that I failed to ask, and I should have, was the markdown that you're using. How portable is that between you and other wikis?
It's not that portable. There are some efforts. It's called the Creole Wiki markup language to standardize that a bit, but I think each of our wiki projects is a bit different. But I think both XWiki and DokuWiki is relatively close to the standard. For DokuWiki, you can also install a plugin which brings DokuWiki closer to the standard. And I think it even fully implements an older version of the standard.
So if I want to do install this and run this in my laptop or in my company, what do I need to do?
You need PHP. In the most recent development version, we can even use the PHP web server that is built in PHP, so you don't need anything else. And otherwise, you just need a regular web server. We also have a DokuWiki on a stick version, which includes a micro Apache, so you can run it from a USB stick.
Okay, and I'll get all this at the DokuWiki website?
Yes, exactly. On DokuWiki.org, you can download everything.
And do you document your own stuff using DokuWiki?
Yes, we do that.
Very good. Trick question. And how can people help out the project?
We are currently needing people, basically also for developing the software. Actually, in the last 1 or 2 years, not that much did happen to DokuWiki because we don't have that many people who are actively contributing. We have many people who are contributing, also plugins. That's also welcome. People can also contribute translations, of course, or help users in our forum. But we're also needing developers who have time to contribute because many people who used to contribute a lot have got other things in their life to do. And so they are still there, but they are not doing that much anymore. So DokuWiki is definitely not dying. DokuWiki is stable, and we have people who also do DokuWiki projects for money, and we have companies who are looking after that. So it will continue to exist, but if you want larger developments, we need more developers.
Okay. Thank you very much. Wiki section, and I'm talking to TikiWiki. Is that correct?
Yes, TikiWiki, CMS Bookware, or Tiki for short.
And you are?
I am Jean-Marc Philippe.
And you, what's your role in the project, other than being the one that everybody pointed to?
I'm one of the developers. I'm also part of the admin group.
Yep.
And, as a role. Well, and apart from that, I contribute to Tiki, and my job is I have my own company, myself, and I work on Tiki, focused on open source and on Tiki. And so I contribute to Tiki depending on what my customers ask from me.
What does it run on? What's the software that you would need in order to make it run?
It's a LAMP stack, so it can be installed pretty much anywhere you like.
And the P is PHP?
Linux, Apache, MySQL, PHP. Of course, you can replace Apache with anything, and MySQL, MariaDB. But basically, it's easy to install. Any hosting company can let you install it, or it's not a problem.
Okay, very good. And why did you were you involved in starting up, or how did you get involved in the project?
I was working in a IT department for some European organization which had a lot of users with a lot of very different activities. Mm-hmm. So we needed something totally versatile so that whatever they asked from us, we could do. And I did some study of what was available, and that was the product with the web product with the most features. So we looked at the code, and the community was active, and we felt, okay, we are confident that we can answer any need and any unforeseen need with Tiki.
Yep.
And so we worked on that in my job. And when I stopped that job, I wondered what I would want to do, and I reflected on the parts I liked on my previous job, and I did, okay, I'll just keep the Tiki part and say that's my main activity now.
Very good.
Because the community was very welcoming, and I was already part of it, so it was I liked the idea.
Okay, so why should I choose TikiWiki above the other projects that are here?
Well, the advantage of TikiWiki it's that it's basically a big toolbox for websites, for complicated websites. So if you have elaborate needs or something that you can't do with prepackaged, simple open source solution or not non-open source solution, it's a good idea to look at Tiki, because we do practically every feature possible on a website or on the web, and actually what you do is at the start you install it and you start to activate those which make sense for what you want to do. So the idea is that however complicated, however your need will evolve, you will be able to do it. It's also very hackable, and the community will let you make it evolve.
So it's a little more than a wiki, you're aiming more at a CMS type thing.
It's much more than a wiki. Yeah. It has a wiki, it has blogs, forums, you can categorize anything. There are databases, data entry, how to output them, how to sort them. You have a plugin with R for statistics.
Mm-hmm.
You can group your users in user groups, in many user groups, and then you have a very fine-grained permission system which you cross with the categories. So you can decide these categories and these users, what can this group of users do on the object of that category.
Right.
So you can build pretty much whatever you want. And I forgot to mention, we have a file garage also. That's where you can store things you want to make online, like images or anything.
Okay, yeah.
So it's more than a wiki, definitely more than a wiki, yes. Some customers are not really interested in a wiki, they want online applications, and I built on that.
Okay, very good. So what do you have planned for coming up this year?
Well, right after FOSDEM, we have rented a flat, and we stay here 2 more days to organize the branching of Tiki 15, which will be the next long-term support Tiki, which is very important because people like long-term support, and it's the first long-term support that's fully responsive using Bootstrap.
Oh, okay. So there's a more current development and a long-term release. I can download a more moving target release and a long-term release.
Yeah, we try to release every 6 months, but usually not.
Yeah.
Every 6 months, some developer releases. Some are good, some are unusable, we only support them until the next one goes out, and every 3 or 4 versions, not it's every 3 versions we publish a long-term release, which we support for years.
Okay, very good. I better wrap up here because I think boots are shutting down and you need to get your addresses. Thank you very much for taking the time and good luck with the rest of Fostime.
Yeah, thank you.
Hello, I'm Marius Hoch. I'm working for Wikimedia Germany, and I'm at the Wikimedia booth. So this booth is about Wikipedia, but also about our sister projects, including Wikidata.
Okay, for the person who has come back in time and doesn't know what come forward in time and doesn't know what Wikipedia is, can you give us a quick rundown of the various different projects?
So yeah, so the most commonly known project probably is Wikipedia, which is a free encyclopedia where everyone can contribute in knowledge. It's fully the content is fully written by the community, and it's freely available for everyone to use and also to reuse.
And Wikimedia and Wikidata?
So Wikimedia is a head organization of all the projects. They run the platforms and do the software development for the platforms in question. And Wikidata is a quite new sister project of Wikipedia, which is a centralized fact base, which is supposed to be used by the Wikipedias, but it can also be used beyond that, as all of its data is available under CC0. So it can be used without any restrictions.
So what sort of data are we talking about here?
So basically on Wikidata, you have an item about every subject which is in Wikipedia. But you also have like items about many more things. But it's basically all of Wikipedia plus more.
So are we talking recordings here or?
No, it's structured data. So for example, you have an item about Berlin, which says the mayor of Berlin is that and that. It has 3.5 million people as population. It's in Germany and all kinds of things like that about cities, about people, about all kinds of topics.
Well, what is the data other than the wiki page?
So it's based on 3 values. So the first value is the subject, so Berlin. Second is the key, population. Third is the value, the number. And then you can annotate that statement. So it's all based on machine-readable statements.
Right. So it's like a big database that you can query.
Yes.
Sorry. And you are?
I'm from the Wikimedia Foundation. I'm a software engineer on the collaboration team. So at the booth, we're also representing MediaWiki, which is the software that powers Wikipedia. It's used for all the Wikimedia Foundation projects, but also like thousands of other sites. And we always are encouraging people to use it and contribute. My team also works on 2 extensions: the Flow extension, which is for discussions on Wikipedia and other MediaWiki sites, and Echo, which is a notification system. They can notify you when someone links to a page you created, if they thank you for your edit, if they leave a message for you and notifies you of what's going on.
Okay, and what was the push to go further than the wiki to develop these services?
Well, for Wikidata, the main use case is that right now you have information about Berlin stored on all wikis in locally. The idea is to, for example, have population counts in a central place so that when there's a new population count for Berlin, you only have to change it in one place.
Oh, okay, yes.
Yeah.
But that will also make it quite nice for me as an end user. I can do queries, data-driven queries against it.
So,
using name value fields and get back the value.
So as told, all of the data is...
Sorry, I'm very slow. It's been a long night.
So we have a public query endpoint, which can be found at query.wikidata.org.
Right.
And there are several examples on it. It is Buckle-based, which is a standard, which can be used. It's very well documented on the internet. And as told, we also have examples which you can start working on with, and it's very easy to get your first results if you just use the examples and go from there.
Okay, and you're... do you need help migrating from like a wiki-based structure into a data-based structure? Structured data-based structure.
So, yes, there's an ongoing effort of getting the information which is still on the Wikipedias into Wikidata, to get data from other sources into Wikipedia data, to source the information which is in Wikidata with external resources, And there's also an ongoing effort to actually when we place old data for in the Wikipedias with references to Wikidata.
So, okay, I'm finally, there's like a sun is shining down upon me now. I'm kind of getting this. So the idea obviously would be to have governments themselves who are paying people to generate this data in census form, they would directly put it into Wikidata and that would be available there as a query source.
Well, they can do that, but it's also be all of our content is on Wikidata as well, is from the community, and there's a lot of people who import data from various sources. So they, for example, take open government data and import that using some scripts and things like that. But they're also taking data from Wikipedia and all kinds of other sources.
Is there like a standard that you can just give to my local government and say, here's the standard, I want all the public data to be put into the standard so we can import it into a public point like that?
There is no standard for data which for input data.
Yeah.
But obviously, if you want to get data which is easy to import, it should be machine readable in some way. It can even be a CSV or maybe a JSON or XML. It doesn't really matter as long as it's well annotated and machine readable. People can figure that out quite well.
And when we pull down the data from Wikidata, say the population of Berlin, is there a way for me to see where that information came from, the original source of that?
Yes. So each value on Wikidata can have multiple references, which can be external websites. It can be a reference to a book. It can be a reference to an external other database which has information about that topic. And it's also possible to qualify a value, so you can say, well, Berlin has 3.5 million people, and we measure that was measured by that and that method, and the reference is whatever.
The accuracy.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Anything else? Is there anything that we as a community can do to help out?
Yes, so we are always looking forward to people checking out Wikidata, using our data, contributing data, or even just looking at Wikidata and getting an idea what it is. It's probably
excellent stuff. I'm at the Linux from Scratch booth, and I'm talking to...
Hi, good morning, everybody.
And sorry, what is your name?
Jean-Philippe Mangal.
And what is your relationship with Linux from Scratch?
Well, I've worked on Linux from Scratch since 2008, and I have started with translating this project, and now we have the French books which are translated, and all the community, a French community, which maintains the book in French and which has some relationship with upstream in English, so that we contribute with patches and with patches to the book.
Okay, just to let people might not be familiar with Linux from Scratch, can you give us a brief overview of what the project is?
Yeah, Linux from Scratch is a book, a set of books, to be more precise, which explains how to build your own system by hand and manually. So when you read this book and you follow this book, you have a full functional system at the end of the process, and you can use it, for example, to build your own distribution.
So every time I look at Linux from Scratch, I get a back pain. And the reason for that is I was on my back for 6 weeks and I installed Linux from Scratch. So it's definitely something everybody should do. How often do you update the book?
Well, it's a distribution that you need to install for two reasons. Only if you want to learn things on the Linux architecture, and if you want to have a customized system, a very customized system. It's not designed for every user, I think, for any user. I think it's rather dedicated for users who have some experience in the GNU Linux system and in the command line in particular. And so you have some users who cannot do it. For example, Ubuntu users who don't know anything in command line, they cannot use it, of course. But, it needs some experience, but it explains everything. And if you follow it, it's somewhat long because it can take about 1.5 days. But, you can install it without so much problems.
So when I was doing it, I had a SSH session into a remote laptop and then was just copying and pasting commands in. Was that cheating or did I need to type everything?
I don't understand.
Okay. Do you physically have to type everything in or is it okay to copy and paste in commands?
Well, you can download the book on the websites or read the book online, and as you need anyway a host distribution to compile and to build your system, you can cut and paste all the instructions. But you should read anyway the book so that you understand what you cut and paste, and you can customize the commands if needed.
Okay, very good. How do you deal with things like security updates?
Security updates are easy for Linux from scratch because as you build every package from the source, it's very easy to get the updates. So the first thing is that the book is up to date each 6 months. So it's very easy to know the last security updates. And lastly, you can build your own system. You never forget that Linux from scratch is a book that explains to you how you build your system. So if you need to update a package for a security reason, for example, the Linux kernel, for example, you can do it without any problem, without rebuilding all the system or without needing to build all the system. So you can update as you like and at your rhythm. So there isn't any security problem, as you just need to follow the security warnings for all packages.
So SystemD, are you supporting SystemD at this point?
Yeah, we have two releases of the book. We have the first release, which is a SysV, so the traditional boot manager. And you have also SystemD, which is now supported.
Okay, very good. I'm going to ask a question that I'm asking all the distros. Can you explain to me how supported accessibility is in your distribution?
Well, again, Linux from scratch is a project where you do what you want. So, actually, given that you build it from a host distribution, if accessibility works on the host distribution through a screen reader or a braille reader, it's not a problem. You can build it without any problem. Then, the book doesn't explain actually how you can install a screen reader. No, to be precise, the book doesn't explain how you can install a braille reader, but it explains. Well, there is a release which explains how you can install the screen reader, so you can also try installing it, and if you manage to make the graphical stack work, you can make work the screen reader.
Okay, very good. What sort of a reader have you got there?
Well, how many readers? The website mentions that we have 40,000 users which are reported as I finished LFS. So I think we have some hundreds of readers a year.
Okay, very good. And your Braille interface device, can you tell us a little bit more about how that works?
What?
Your interface device for communicating.
Yeah.
Can you tell us how that works and what you need to get it running?
Yeah, well, to access the system, I use a device which enables to read with fingers Braille on the screen, and which enables to type on the computer using the Braille keyboard, so that the person who uses it just need to know Braille and to write in Braille and to read in Braille to have an access to the information.
Do you use a screen reader yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. I use only screen reader on GNU Linux, that is Orca. Orca, which works perfectly on desktops such as GNOME 3 and Mate, and the last for other desktop environments such as KDE or XFCE. But yes, I use a screen reader. Yeah.
Okay, very good. So is there anything new coming up in the project that you want to make us aware of?
I don't understand.
What new things are happening? Are you having a new release this year or...?
Yeah, of course. Last release has been released in October, I think. And as we release each 6 months, we probably will have a new release during April or May, I think, the time that the authors update the book. And of course, we have also a release before the end of this year. So April for the first release and likely October or November for the next release. So we will have at least two releases in 2016.
Very good. Is there anything that you want to say that I haven't covered in the interview?
Well, I would like to say that any contribution is welcome. So the contribution for LFS isn't so difficult because you needn't necessarily to patch or to know to code, etc. But reading the book, you just need to report the bugs you see, report the patches, and you can help easily to update the book. In particular, the book about beyond LFS. Because LFS, there are several books, and the first book is for the base system, so I can understand that it's difficult to update because it's the base of the system. But beyond LFS maintains the packages for the end user. So you can help testing them, and you can help saying how you build them and how you update them. So it's very easy to contribute to Linux from scratch when you want to build things manually and you want to learn things about how a system works.
Thank you very much for taking the time, and I hope you enjoy the rest of FOSDEM.
You're welcome.
Hi everybody, this is Ken. I'm at the Pearl booth, avoiding being sold stuff by Wendy. And I'm talking to...
Mark Keating.
Wendy van Dijk.
Hi. So, tell me, what is Pearl?
Pearl is an awesome programming language. It's a dynamic language. It's used all over the world. It's one of the most used programming languages ever. We have now Pearl 5 and Pearl 6. Pearl 5, everybody knows. It's installed on every server in the world. Most of the internet is working on Pearl, and now we have Pearl 6 as a sister, and she's also awesome, and she does amazing things, and is multi-core, multi-processing, and object-oriented, and fun to try.
But you're going to continue developing Pearl 5 along with Pearl 6, so they're like two...
Can I add that Pearl's both the oldest and now the youngest of the programming languages? Well done. So we managed to get both of those, because Pearl 6 is 1 month old. It might have been in development for 15 years, but it's only 1 month old.
Okay. So what was the need for Pearl 6?
There was a need for a complete rewrite as far as a language developer thought.
Yeah.
So he wanted to basically scratch his own personal itches and to rewrite the language. And that's actually fine. What's the problem with having more than one programming language?
Well, would it not be better to call it Pearl, I don't know, Emerald or something?
No, we have had discussions about the naming of Pearl 6. The boss of Pearl is Larry Wall. He decides what happens to Pearl and the naming about that. So he decided it's going to be called Pearl 6. And we can jump high and low, and we can discuss this forever. He decides.
I'm going to go with Shakespeare. What's in a name? A rose by any other name, smiles as sweet. Call it whatever you like.
It's poetry right here at the desk.
Yeah, I'm sorry, that's the way it goes.
He's an English major, so...
Excellent.
And Pearl has a lot to do with poetry and language.
So it does, yes. That kind of helps a little bit. But I've said it to you before. Dave Morris, who's a big fan of Pearl, has taught me everything I know. And I go from loving the language to hating the language. And that can change in the space of walking to the coffee machine and coming back.
Absolutely. I do that with English as well. There is a lot to think about it in terms of as a language. So Pearl is adaptable and makes you think like you think. And sometimes you go around hating the way you say things.
Yes.
And that's how Pearl works. So it's all about a mindset. Pearl is much more based around grammatical mindset and a linguistic mindset than it is a structural or programmatic mindset. And so that's why you have so much variance in it and richness and verboseness and so much crazy.
Yeah. The thing is, when I compare my code to the stuff Dave sent me, the example programs, mine looks like a chunk of gibberish and his looks like a actual work of art that you could print out and put on the wall.
I have the same when I do my poetry, and look at Coleridge's poetry. Mine looks like a hunk of gibberish. But yeah, that's the way that Pearl works. But we've got a lot of good things in Pearl that help you to avoid that. So you can use Pearl Critic, you can use Pearl Tidy, you can extend them and make them more your programming style or make them more stricter. And by using those, you can make much better Pearl. and your team can make much better Perl. You can even format it so it looks like another programming language. And if that makes sense to you, you can do that. And then there's adding a lot of syntactic sugar to things. So you can use things like Moose. You can use Moo. You can add some syntactic sugar in there.
And to complete that, if you're working in a company with several people working on the same project, it's a nice way to coordinate everybody trying to keep the same style, have a company style. You could use a book like Perl Best Practices that I'm showing you right now.
She's trying to tempt me, ladies and gentlemen.
I've sold you books before, so I will not try to do it this time.
I actually wouldn't mind buying that particular one.
Okay, but it's sort of a guideline for your company on how to use several ways of working with Perl. Yeah. You don't have to follow the guidelines that set in the book, but have a discussion in your company on how to do this, how to do that, agree on stuff like that. And if you have a new person coming in your company, have them read that and have them apply to the guidelines.
Yeah.
And if I may go back about Perl 5 and Perl 6, you asked me, will it be developed further? Yes, we just had the release candidate for the new version of Perl 5, Perl 5.24, coming out in May. And Perl 5 will be around maybe forever, just like Perl 6. And they will be coexist for a long time, I hope. And so it will be developed further.
There's and also a lot of community and companies based around Perl who are all about improving the best practices of Perl. So you'll find lots of trainers, developers, advocates, lots of people inside the community that if you ask a question of how can I make my Perl better, you'll get a good answer.
Yeah.
And they're willing to do that a lot of the time just because they'd like you to write better Perl. We've had our decade of really badly written Perl, and we're getting rid of that. And we got rid of it about a decade ago. Perl is that old. We've been around a long time. We had our bad times, and we had our times where basically we got rid of a lot of cruft. And now Perl's been written a lot nicer. The programmers are a lot better. The development's a lot better. The community's a lot better. A lot more willing to help. A lot better practices.
Use strict at the top really helps.
Use strict, use warnings. Yes, absolutely. And as I said, Perl critic, Perl tidy makes your code look a lot more readable. And you can set a lot of custom stuff. And then you can learn a lot of things from the people already in the community. And if you want to learn Perl, it's really easy.
That is actually something I wanted to talk to both of you about. Seems to be a lot of push with Python now. Especially with the Raspberry Pi, and although Perl is on there as well. So what is the best way to get kids or young people involved in Perl, writing Perl code?
That's a good question. Best way to get young kids involved in writing Perl code? Use a Raspberry Pi and Perl sets?
Yes.
Write a Hello World script. Go to learn.perl.org or perlsets.org. There are simple scripts. If you're going to teach your children programming, depends on their age. A six-year-old is not going to get Perl straight away. You're going to be teaching them Scratch. But if they're 13, 14, go to learn.perl.org. Start a simple script. Learn with them. That's the best way to learn anything. And not only that, find something that they want to do. Because in any programming language, it's not about learning what somebody else did. It's about learning a tiny bit of the language and then thinking of something you want to do.
I don't have children. Mark has, so he knows more about that than me. But I know one thing about children, they like games. So one of the nicest games is to develop games yourself.
Yep.
Perl 6, I think, is one of the ideal language to produce games.
Yep.
One of the first things that is developed in Perl 6 now is games.
Okay.
So Space Invaders was the first one. And I was surprised how lightning fast it was. I lost completely every game. I couldn't win from the computer because it was too fast. So the guy is now inserting a throttle to throttle it down. Well, this is interesting for kids.
I have to say, while we're stood here, I'm looking at Curtis Poe, who's writing a super cool game in Perl that's going to be out sometime soon.
I'm not certain exactly when it's going to be out. We're hoping to have a pre-alpha out by the summer. But that'll be invite only. I can't share the name yet because we have some legal hoops we have to jump through. But it's basically a text-based MMORPG running in a browser called Vir. And a lot of people have been having fun. We've got an entire team working on it. And it's been an absolute blast. And one of the nice things I've really appreciated is Perl has an embarrassment of riches in being able to build out things like this. There are so many different web frameworks you can choose from, so many different ORMs, so many different things for making this easy. And any time I've had a problem, which isn't business specific to what we're doing, there's always been a wonderful tool out there which has allowed me to get it done. And it's just rock solid. I love that.
Just one second. Dave Morris, one of our Perl experts and community members, is sitting over there in the corner avoiding...
You should probably be doing this. Yes, I was listening to some of the Perl talks. Perl 6 was cool. But, yeah.
Any questions for the team here?
For Curtis?
Yep.
Yeah. So, Curtis, is it going to be extensible? Can I add stuff to it? Your game when it comes out?
This is not planned for the alpha release.
But is there a future point where you see that happening?
Yes, there is a future point. Basically, one of the things we've been thinking about doing is internally we're following the standard model view controller model, MVC, but we have what, as you should be, extremely, extremely thin controllers. The controllers are often just a single line of code in there connecting the view and the model. And as a result, the controllers right now are specific to the web. We can replace much of that with an API layer, allowing people to write their own clients. If you wanted to, then when we finish this, you could write a command line client, in Bash, you just write a quick command line client to interface a thing, and you could actually be playing an MMORPG from the command line.
So we were asked about children coming into Perl, and one of the ways that I think children have come more into programming now is Minecraft. So your game could be the same way. If children can actually extend it themselves in a simple enough way, would that not be a way also bringing them into the Perl community?
Oh, that would certainly be an interesting way of doing that. I think a lot of the things for the Perl community is finding out what the children are actually doing. Games are one of it. Part of it's organizing their music or, you know, better ways of doing social sharing, things like that. And that's the sort of thing which the children are really paying attention to today. And if we were doing more of that, focusing on more of those issues for them, I think that would help also. But yes, games are going to be a huge thing there.
That's awesome.
You got a question? Yeah. That's a bit kind. I was actually at your talk just a short while ago, so I was bowled over by what Perl 6 can do. I mean, it's not very obvious from the remote observer where Perl 6 is now, and you know, it needs more of what you were doing today to get the word out, I guess, to people who've just been thinking, it's nothing to do with me. I'll get to it eventually. But is it easy for somebody like me to go and get access to it and use it and stuff? I mean, is it going to be in my Debian distribution, for example?
I do know there's some work being planned for various distributions. There are some versions out there. But largely right now, with the stable feature release last Christmas, a lot of people are just installing Recudo Brew, and they're building it manually that way. And so I just have an alias on my laptop. I call it called Rebuild Recudo, which automatically rebuilds Recudo, the package manager, and Recudo being the back end for Perl 6. And it was interesting, though, when you were talking about, you know, from a distance, not knowing what's going on, and then you're blown away by it. This is what I'm seeing over and over again when I talk to people who've never seen Perl 6 before. And it's not there's that one feature that happens to scratch that happens to scratch everyone's itch. You know, there's things like, you know, Go, for a lot of people, is just a concurrency. Even though Go's a great language, but it's kind of trapped in the DevOps world. The interesting thing about, say, Perl 6, by the way, I didn't mean to throw shade on Go there. I apologize. Interesting thing about Perl 6 is it seems to scratch everyone's itch in different ways. You know, whether they're looking for grammars, whether they're looking for a more robust type system, they're looking for, you know, it's probably the most advanced object-oriented system anyone's ever going to be playing with, ever. They need, you know, working concurrency in a dynamic language. There are so many different things which people actually want, and they're finding it's available, and it's all put together very nicely, very cleanly.
So 15 years of waiting has been worth it. I started at Perl 4. I took over a program somebody'd written in Perl 4 with all the tick marks and everything in it and tried to work from there. But, you know, this sounds like the promised land from that point of view.
It is a strange thing. There are other languages which have been rushed out there very quickly. This time I'm not going to make the mistake of accidentally jumping on them. But there are some that I have seen that they've been pushed out there and they are timid in what they offer, or the features haven't been well composed together. They weren't planned out. So you get a mishmash of stuff put together, and you're always looking up the documentation because you can't remember which order the arguments are in. And Perl 6, I won't say that it's perfect. Everyone's idea of paradise is going to be different. And there are certain problem domains it's probably not going to be your first choice for, just as that's the case with every programming language. But it is so rich in what it's done. And they took so long to make sure that they actually got it right. And they learned a lot from initial pre-implementations with what's called pugs and other things where people were trying beforehand to find out what can we actually do with this. To the point now where you have a nice, cohesive, coherent language where all the pieces are put together. And it's astonishing. You know, having types actually map to what you as the business need as opposed to what the computer needs. That's a huge one. That's going to be big. The gradual typing being built in the language, meta operations available for classes, the working concurrency in a dynamic language. That just doesn't exist right now for the most part. Yeah, you say JavaScript and WebSockets, but I'm not going to go there right now. It's fabulous. I love what I'm seeing with it.
I have no idea what you just said, but I'm sure I missed the talk. Links to the talk will be in the show notes for this episode. So is there anything else that you guys want to ask or share with the community? Big thing is Perl 6 is coming, I'm guessing, this year.
One thing I'll say about Perl 5, so I run a company all around the world, .fr, and we do training consulting in Perl 5. And the interesting thing, which really surprised me after I started the company, we're doing a lot of new Perl development. Companies are coming to us and saying, you know, we would like this system. We would like this built in Perl. We feel very comfortable with it. You know, Perl's battle tested. It's been around for a long time. It's not like some others, which, you know, sometimes they've been great. Sometimes, you know, they've been pulled away at the last moment and or they've been forked. Perl's been solid. And I've been surprised at the amount of new Perl that we're writing.
If I can add to that, I work for a company called Shadowcat Systems. We do consultancy. We find a lot of companies that have gone away from Perl and are now coming back, because they went away, tried to rebuild the thing in a different language, thinking that Perl was perhaps entering a mode of not being supported, and have found that they need to do it back in a Perl way, because it worked better for them then. So sometimes the business model is based around the fact the language you originally built from. So that can happen as well. So there's a lot of, as Curtis said, a lot of new projects being built in Perl, new companies being built in Perl, very big things built in Perl, and a lot of people returning to it and realizing that they probably shouldn't have gone away.
Yeah, you'd be astonished at the size of some of the projects we work on. Some of them I can't talk about because of non-disclosure agreements, but we have one which is collecting network data over the entirety of, you know, countries in Europe, and is expanding from there, and has to do that very fast, getting close to real-time data for their clients in order to be able to monitor their information. And it's astounding how easy it was to do with Perl and, you know, the size and scope of what we're doing with that.
That doesn't strike me as like a interpreted language would be able to be that fast.
So a lot of people misunderstand what's actually happening with performance. When we talk about it, sometimes you're talking about the performance of the developer, sometimes you're talking about the performance of the computer. Performance of the developer, we know dynamic languages often excel at that. But the performance of the computer, what's actually happening there? Quite often when you're dealing with performance issues, when I am, you know, running profilers trying to find out where the performance has gone, we're talking about network latency. We're talking about disk I/O. We're talking about so many errors which have virtually nothing to do with the programming language itself. Now, would I want to write a real-time ray tracer in Perl? No, that's going to be CPU bound, and that's not going to be good. But if you're not CPU bound, and sometimes even if you are, depending upon the problem domain you're working with, I know Perl 5 regular expressions, for example, often will allow you to parse text faster than writing it in C. So, but generally speaking, much of the performance issues that you find in larger systems are not tied to the programming language itself. So that's becoming less of a concern as a general rule. But that also depends. When you're writing very specific things, and we're talking about, you know, Moore's Law, hitting up against Moore's Law, there are things which are still going to require super lightning fast performance. And there you go to C++ or something like that.
And also we have the programmer. I strongly suspect my code would run slightly slower than any of your guys' code.
That's possible. But there's a lot of great tools out there for, you know, like DevelNYT Prof is a fantastic one for, you know, finding out exactly where the performance problems are showing up in your code. It's wonderful.
Okay. Guys, thank you very much for taking the time, and good luck this year with Perl. Congratulations. Well done, Dave. What's the name of the project?
The project is a Baggers project.
And your name is?
Jean-Baptiste.
Now, I was trying to look up some information on this project before I came, and there was nothing. It is secret to me, so I know nothing about your project.
Because it's quite a new project for now. It started as a school project, but now we are continuing as an open source one. It's 2 years of research and 1 year of development, and it's almost released on the open source community. So what is Bagas? Bagas is basically a set of tools aimed to ease the analysis, static analysis of binaries and Intel architectures. So in short, we are taking a binary, we are mapping it in memory on a graph, and then we are emulating the whole set of instructions on the graph to detect anything we want.
What does anything we want mean?
Since it's modular and the virtual machine is running a set of tools to work with the assembly, anything you want to do with assembly, the main goal is debugging, so detecting issues with the codes that will lead to a crash or undefined behavior. But in the future, it can be even used for security, reverse engineering, and this kind of stuff.
So these can be closed binaries or drivers from a third party or something?
Yeah. Yeah, but it's not on the close bound of the project, since we are only working for now on user space assembly, not kernel space and special instruction like cache instruction and floating point instruction and vectorization instruction, which are a bit tricky to handle according to the way we handle the variable statically.
Okay, why is this project needed? Who uses it?
The usage is to complement what is on the market. On the market, there are several solutions already. There is Veracode, but Veracode is aimed for the corporation, for the company. It's expensive. It's not for the regular developers. There are tools like Valgrind and GDB, but unfortunately, that's dynamic analysis, and they can find a flaw in the code only if they run into once at the moment you run the tools. So we are working statically because we want a full coverage of the binary, and we are working on the assembly because we want to be language independent, any compiled language. Also, this will allow us to detect flaws in the compiler because we can't trust the language itself. I have an example.
Okay, I'm looking at a screen. Yes?
I have a simple loop with a compiler, something that is incrementing a variable from 0 to 120. And unfortunately, if you compile this with GCC 4.8 and above, it's doing some loop unrolling. And the optimization module crashed because it assumes there won't be any overflow during the whole unrolling, and it does not raise any warning. So the code is completely unfinished and crashed. So here, I'm going to compile with O2, run the code, and just generate a segmentation fault.
But so you're basically writing code of my quality.
Yeah, the code is perfectly clean, but the compiler is doing things wrong with it. So that's the kind of issue we are going to detect, but we are not detecting right now because we are rewriting a whole part of the code, the emulation part, and it's not ready yet to be released.
Okay, and when do you think it will be ready to be released?
Oh, good question. Since we are working on it weekend after the work at night, it might be a few months before the first beta will be ready to use on simple C code. C++ will be harder to learn due to exception, virtual, and the decompilation of the code might be harder to do. So a few months for me.
So how can people help out with the programming? I think this is fairly hardcore stuff, or am I missing? I suspect.
Yeah, some hard code behind this on the emulation part, but for the contribution of the code, it won't be available for now since the repository are not open yet. A few of them are open, but not all of them. When we are going to release the first program, then there will be tasks on it, and the user will be able to contribute and send some pull requests on the different part of the project.
Okay, and you're here at FOSDEM in order to try and get more developers on board?
Not yet. The first goal is to present the project, tell we are here, we exist, and we are going to do some cool, really cool stuff that are going to be awesome.
Excellent. Being awesome. That is awesome. Do you have anything to add? Anything that I've missed? So Can our community help out, or it's basically sit and wait for your code to be released?
Sorry, can you repeat?
So is there any way that our community is varied from the beginner right up to the very technical? Is there anything that we can do to help, or do we need to just wait a while until the code is released?
You mean for the end user to only use it or to contribute? Both. To use it, it will be really, really easy to use. It's same for this, like Valgrind. Just run the program, give a parameter to the user program you want to analyze, and by default, we will add all the modules that will run. Zero division, pointer arithmetic, and any kind of issues you can detect. And for the contributor, unfortunately, they will have to wait until we release the full API of the code.
Okay, so two questions. What is it written in? What programming language? And what is the license that you're going to release it under?
Okay, the license used is BSD2. And it's written basically in C++, 11, and assembly for the most low-level part.
Why did you pick the BSD license?
BSD instead of GPL because we want the code to be used in security later and no matter the field. So we don't want to restrict the usage of the code at all.
Is there anything that I forgot to ask that I should have asked?
There might be some technical things I would like to say, but that will take too much time for now for the interview.
You know what you can do is record a show and submit it to HBR. They will love this sort of stuff.
Yeah, but for this we will need to register to other open conference and register for a talk. And then yeah, for sure.
Okay, very good. And I'm talking to?
Lasse Schumann.
Hi, could you tell me what the project is all about?
So, with Koala, we are trying to reduce redundancy.
Koala, that's what the bear is for.
Koala, yeah. So, with Koala, we are trying to reduce redundancy in static code analysis. So, if you have various tools like PyLint and CSSLint and stuff like that, they all rewrite the whole user interface. And that kind of sucks, because that is all doubled work. And so Koala is a framework that allows you to just write your logic in one function and throw that into Koala, and then you get your whole usability for free.
So what type of program are you talking about? Is it specific to one particular programming language, or can I use any programming language?
So Koala provides you with usability and modularity. Yeah. So that is nothing language specific. Koala does not create any kind of abstract syntax tree or so. So you can use it on any text-based thing. We actually have routines for checking for spelling errors and inconsecutive writing and stuff like that.
Okay. So say I'm writing something in Perl, for instance. I've just come from the Perl booth, and I've written a Hello World program. What do I need to do next?
So for Perl, we currently don't have any routines that can do any checking. But they can be added very easily.
Programming language, Python?
Python works very well because Koala is written in Python. So Koala can give you any hints about you not complying to PEP 8. It can remove unused imports. It can use everything that PyLint can, because we sometimes integrate with other tools because we want to remove redundancy, not create some. Koala can also automatically fix stuff if you configure it that way. So you can do all of that with Koala.
Give me an example of automatically fixing stuff.
So, for example, if you're working in the Atom text editor, and you're inserting an import and you don't use it, or you remove some code that uses some imports on the top, and then Koala could, if you configure it that way, automatically on save, remove that unused import. And you don't need to do anything about it. Or you execute it via the command line, and it would do the same.
Okay, so I've written a program. Do I need to configure specific stuff, or is there a generic library that you check for regular, you know, general Perl or Python issues? Or do I need to specifically look for some myself?
So you need to configure Koala with a configuration file or via the graphical user interface, which we are currently working on. It's a prototype. Or the command line interface, so you don't have to write it manually. But you do need to configure it, That is because essentially in Koala, you can use any routine for any programming language. That way you can combine language independent routines with language dependent routines. So if you have something that corrects spacing, you can reuse that for everything and you don't need to rewrite that for your next programming language you might write tomorrow.
So that you could then introduce coding styles for your style sheets, for your HTML, for your embedded PHP.
And you can do all of that in one configuration file.
So what describe what I need to do to install this, what sort of server I need and where I need to run it.
So Koala runs directly on your PC. You need Python 3, and you can just install it with pip 3 install Koala.
Couldn't be easier. Couldn't be easier. So long as you got pip installed, of course.
Yeah.
Do you? Can you tell me a little bit about your? Is this a company? Is this a foundation? Or what's the management of the Koala team?
Koala is actually only a pile of developers who are doing this in their free time because they think it's important.
Okay, that's a good answer. And you're not federated with anybody? Or what sort of license is it released under?
Koala is released under AGPL. AGPL 3. Yeah.
Free as in freedom. Is there anything else that's coming up this year that you want to tell us about?
So we're currently writing on an integration into GitHub of Koala. So that way it can actually review your pull requests automatically on its own. Like you submit a pull request and you will get comments right in the lines where there are issues, which may even show you some patches how to fix that.
So it's also a way of improving your code as... Yeah, I suppose that's the whole point, is to improve your code.
Yes.
Is there any way that we as a community can help out?
Anyone can help out by using it. Filing bugs, of course. We love bugs because known bugs are better than unknown bugs. You can, of course, help out by contributing. It is very easy to integrate your favorite linter into Koala. It is very easy to integrate Koala in your favorite editor, and that way you can connect all of them at once.
Fantastic. Hi, everybody. This is Ken. I'm at the Google Summer of Code booth, and I'm talking to...
This is Mary Rademeyer from Google.
You have actually been on HBR before.
I have, back in 2011, I believe, at the LinuxCon in Boston.
Excellent stuff.
Linux Fest in Boston.
No problem. Can you give us, people are probably familiar with it, but can you give us the elevator spiel?
So Google Summer of Code is a student program. We pay students to work for open source organizations over the summer and work on a large coding project. Google accepts 150 open source organizations-ish, and then they come up with a list of projects for students to work on. Students then apply to the projects. They meet... They greet, they bond, they have a good time, and then students code for 12 weeks over the summer, and hopefully they come out of it with a really great experience. They've learned a little bit about open source, and the free software projects get new contributor and hopefully a long-time developer.
So. I think this was the alternative to flipping burgers this was the alternative to spending your summer flipping burgers, that you're actually doing something constructive.
Yes, absolutely. So it was either, I believe our old saying was flip bits, not burgers. Yes.
And what are the age restrictions in order to be involved in the project?
There's no age restrictions. You just need to be a student. And if you're not a student, you could participate as a mentor. So you could work for an open source organization and mentor a student through the summer.
And what are the... you mentioned there that you needed to meet the team. Is that physically or virtually?
It's all virtual, so you can be anywhere. There's no requirement to travel at all. You can be wherever your computer has an internet access. So you do all the community bonding online through IRC channels, discussion lists, whatever the project prefers.
Okay, and there are... So can you give me the details of where somebody can go to get more information?
I've got it right in front of me. So for more information about Google Summer of Code, go to g.co/GSOC, G-S-O-C. And then we'll have all the information about the timelines and when to apply and when mentoring organizations can apply. And
are there any deadlines coming up?
Absolutely. So the next deadline is February 8th. It's not a deadline. The program opens February 8th, where orgs can start applying to be a project for the summer.
Okay, very good. Hi, everybody. This is Ken. I'm up here at the Ultimaker. I'm not going to call it a booth. I'm going to call it an experience.
Oh, wow.
And you are?
I'm Oliver. Hi.
We spoke again a few years ago. So tell us what Ultimaker is, if anybody out there doesn't know what it is.
Okay. Ultimaker is a manufacturer of open source 3D printers. We have open source software stack, and even the machines are open source.
That's amazing. And you have, well, everybody knows what a 3D printer is now.
Well, last year we had many surprise visitors. This year, many of the surprise visitors again. Still everybody's like, oh, wow, oh, wow. It's mostly that people are surprised what you can do with a 3D printer especially people in the industry, as opposed to regular injection molding. So that's one of the amazements that we see. And mostly just new people, you know, new generations that visit here. And then it's like, oh, wow, this is so cool. Maybe they heard about it on the internet or read about it on the internet.
HBR, obviously.
But, you know, when you can see it and touch it, and unfortunately the listeners cannot see it, but the print wall there is so impressive. It's very, very simple. It's just a few prints printing, but it just looks impressive.
Yeah, I'm going to have a picture of this in the show notes as well, but I think all our listeners are regularly drooling over your website.
I hope so. Thank you.
No problem. So tell us, let's walk through some of the models that you have available and what the prices are.
Okay. I'm very bad with prices, and especially since we only sell to resellers at the moment, prices are with the resellers.
Okay,
the most well-known reseller at the moment we just recently achieved is Apple. So you can buy it in the Apple store. Under the printer section, yes.
3D.
Yes, Apple.
Open source.
Yes, Apple. Very surprising. So we start with the basic one. We call it the hobbyist, the one that's most interesting for the people here. It's the wooden version. It looks, because it's a laser cut from plywood, so it looks more, you know,
awesome.
More awesome. Like, for the people here, absolutely more awesome. You have to assemble it yourself.
Yep.
It's like IKEA / Lego for adults, I guess. It starts, I think, around $1,200 with everything the other printers have as well. It's just, you know, you have to build it yourself. Then we have the small one, the Ultimaker 2 Go. I have to be very careful
Don't
what I say now.
Let's skip over the prices.
The pricing is okay. It's €1,500 or near the $1,200 mark. It's just I personally, and this is my opinion, of course, it's very small. It has a print size of 10 by 10 by 10 centimeters, and there's only so much you can print. So if you were debating between the two, the wooden build-it-yourself one and the small one, I would still recommend the wooden one because you get the full size of the regular printer.
How big is that?
The regular size is 20 by 20 by 20.
Okay.
So centimeters, by the way. And then we have also the regular Ultimaker 2 Plus, a new one this year, actually, a 2 Plus, where we change the heating end. You can easily now user change the nozzles, but just unscrewing it and screwing a smaller or bigger nozzle on it, and a stronger feeder. It was one of the problems that we had with the previous generation. So all the new ones have that. So we have the small one, the normal size one, 20 by 20, and we also have the extended, which is 20 by 20 by 30.
Oh, nice.
And if you, again, the readers or the listeners can't hear see it, but if you look behind the printer, the rocket, it's one of those things you can more easily print with the bigger... it's a bomb, actually. It's not a rocket.
I thought that was made out of wood, actually. It's quite well carved.
So, yeah.
Pretty cool. I can see 3D printing from a manufacturing point of view as being an excellent replacement for rapid prototyping.
Yeah.
And there are definitely some intricate designs that you can do with 3D printing that you can't do with injection molding machines. But when people are looking at, I would never have considered 3D molding, 3D printing as a replacement for injection molding, given the speed and stuff.
It's not. 3D printing is, as you said, it's perfect for prototyping, but also small-scale manufacturing. If you need, say, and I'm trying to make up a bizarre example here, but say you sell...
I actually have a good example if you want one.
Go ahead.
There was a guy who has a fleet of Ferraris that he rents out.
Yeah.
And there's a little plastic doohickey on the steering wheel.
Yeah.
And it cost him €150 to get them printed. To replace the steering wheel, to get Ferrari to replace it, it's €40,000 to replace.
But that's more marketing kind of, you know, like availability and exactly what you'd say. No. With small scale manufacturing is say you have a small business and you want to sell customized lamp hoods, for example.
Yeah.
You want people or mugs, I don't know. You can offer the option to your customers to have their name embossed on it. You know, it's like a 3D sticks out. You're not going to run an injection mold factory for that, even for the common names. You're unlikely. So if you need to make a couple of hundred, easy, 3D print it.
Yeah. And small kits as well.
Yeah. There was actually in Hackaday an article just yesterday or 2 days ago, I think, about, or maybe it was Slashdot, I don't remember, about, guys, what's the cheapest, best way to print Legos? And that's like the perfect example, which you cannot do with a 3D printer. Lego is known for their super high precision injection molding, super high precision.
Yeah.
You cannot achieve that with a 3D printer. Also, the plastics used degrade faster than the Legos. Legos are the same as 40 years ago. Yeah. 3D printing, it's not going to happen.
The accuracy of the there's a lot going into Lego bricks. Non-engineering types.
From the Ultimaker's point of view, there's like four, well, I would call it I'm not a marketing guy. I'm a software engineer. I'm just, you know, there's the four markets that we envision. It's the small-scale manufacturing.
Yeah.
It's the architects that want prototypes, mostly fast prototypes or, you know. But even to do simple casts, you know, because you can take a piece of plastic or a print piece of plastic, put it in sand, pour aluminum on it, and the plastic just vaporizes and you have an aluminum mold.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's some ways for it. And then the educational sector, you know, schools, which is kind of like the prototyping because, you know, the universities, they want to do prototypes as well. And then the middle schools with, you know, educational in general. There was a project where a guy printed some parts for the biology department to build an aquatronics. Like hydroponics, but for aquatronics, yeah.
Oh, that's similar.
Like whole aquatronics system. You know, and then the kids are, it's like a whole course, you know, first they do the whole 3D printing bit and then they assemble it and they see the whole thing. So education. And then of course the full STEM crowd, the hackers, the makers, we started from that corner. We started in the product space and maker space. The community is very valuable to us, very important to us, and we still cherish that very much.
How does that actually work in a real sense, other than like the promotional aspect? Do you get actual development codes back? Do you get ideas back?
Yes, absolutely. The new hotend I mentioned earlier, the exchangeable nozzles, that actually is a piece that came from the community that we brought back into a machine as an upgrade.
Oh, that's awesome.
We also sell as an upgrade kit. It's called the Flexi Drive. Which allows printing of flexible materials more easily. It's a community developed thing. Some guy in England developed it, and we made somewhat of a product out of it. And it's not, you know, like a regular product that we sell to regular people, but you know it's something we can buy. You can buy or make yourself.
Yeah.
So that in that sense, yes, absolutely. But that's hardware, open hardware hacking. It's much more difficult. It's to get contribution, to verify contributions. It takes a lot of time and effort on our side, and on their side. It's a different kind of people. Software-wise, it's easier. You know, it has been software community development has been around for ages now, and in that regard, we see more.
We had a contribution from one of our hosts from Lafayette, Louisiana, and they have done their library. They've updated their bibliothèque. And in there they have a 3D printer and a knitting section and stuff. I would like you to I would like my local library to have a 3D printer.
I absolutely agree. Very slightly costly, especially for situations like that. But I would say absolutely. They should. Community centers, libraries. I even saw and they didn't have one. I wish they had. I was thinking they should have, but one of those arts and craft stores. You know, they sell all kinds of expensive doodads.
Yeah,
you know, perfect. You know, you said artists yourselves is one of them.
Yeah.
Put it there. You know, show people what they can do with it.
Excellent. Okay, anything else coming up this year that I need to know about? Or?
Well, we just released, as I said, the new Ultimaker 2 Plus in at the CES.
Yeah.
So that's new.
Are you doing well as a company?
Very well, actually. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Chi-ching.
Yeah, cheating wise, we're doing really, really good. We're still here, you know, so 5 years strong. Well, the only thing I wanted to say to listeners, they're always grumbling about the price. It's so expensive. We're not aiming for race to the bottom. We don't want to take part of the race to the bottom. We don't want to be the cheapest printer and then make the money on the materials, the razor blade model. we value the quality of the printer, the services you get around with it. If it's broken, you know, you can get it repaired easily, etc. That's what we are aiming for.
You know, the price you're at is not, it's not horrendously. It's the price of a laser printer when they come out first.
Of course,
you know,
yeah, it's not, absolutely.
It's not.
In that regard, we're still small scale manufacturing ourselves. I mean, I can't. I don't know if I can release numbers or not. But we're not doing millions of HP printers. You know. So it's a different. Yeah.
It is a precision component. I'm mechanical engineer by trade. I'm mechanical and plastics, which heaven, which is why I really really want one very badly. But that is why you know it's. You just have to. You can't get away when you're dealing with precision like that. You can't get away with cheap stuff. Basically.
Yeah, that's
well, you
true.
Can, but it's going to break, and then it's everyone's going to be disappointed.
What I noticed last year,
oh, Daddy, you made me another floppy, but a floppy bunny.
Yeah. Now, what I noticed last year and this year especially is that people are very, very amazed still at the quality we achieve with these simple machines. You know, some people mention some competitors and say, like, "Oh, we have one at the makerspace. Wow, it doesn't nearly come close to the quality this one does."
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, it's precision machinery, absolutely.
And what I've seen is like people are now beginning to go, "Okay, this is a different way of doing stuff," and the stuff inside of stuff inside of stuff from an art point of view is awesome. But I also saw clocks being made. A guy who made a 3D printed clock, which was huge, you know. But still, as a concept, it was nice. Oh, this is how a watch works and the mechanism works. So cool stuff.
The big problem we had again this year is we didn't prepare well enough. You know, we just we print some prints and we'll just go and it'll be awesome. And then you think, oh, we should have brought this one print that looks really really cool because it moves and it was printed in one go. And
yeah, why don't you, yeah, just make a list for next year. That's all you can do.
Yeah, I tried that last year. I forgot. I guess.
Yeah. Or something. All right. Listen, thank you very much for taking the time. And you know, if ever you want to send one for demo purposes, I'm more than available. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Until next year.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.